sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Hello, friends. Yeah, this is here, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. You're in the right place. Your host, Andrew Horowitz, here, and we're going to be talking about the markets rocking on. Fed's done been tapering, and we got a guest, Sanjay Das, talking to us today. And you just sit back and just get them drinks going, them iced tea brewing, and we're going to be talking about all sorts of fun things here today. So just stick around. Well, hello. Yeah, feeling a little silly today, feeling a little bit crazy this week. Got the holidays coming up, so why not have a little bit of fun with this whole shebang? It's been quite the year in terms of, well, as shebangs go, it's been quite the year of absolute hysteria when it comes to being in the markets and movements of individual securities. I think you've noticed that. You see a stock that has been making their numbers and then misses. Oh boy, they get pummeled. And then at the same time, you see a stock that's been showing a good number, and at the same time, they show a bad outlook, and who knows? It could keep moving on. We've seen things like Amazon do amazing things this year when we saw that their outlook and their continuation of their earnings miss each and every time. But it's the environment that we're talking about right now that is more so in a bullish nature, it seems, but can't forget about these valuations and fundamentals. Now, I wanted to bring up something I thought would be interesting today. We do have a great guest coming on, but I did want to bring up this whole idea about when you hear the words PE expansion. I don't know if you've heard that, but PE expansion, price earnings multiple expansion. What does that mean? Well, we've heard things like, for example, well, stock's going to do better because earnings are going to do better. Revenues are going to do better. We're going to see that the debt structure of their balance sheet is better. But what does PE expansion actually mean? And I think it's important to look at this because you'll start hearing about this quite often, because now many of the folk that are on the side of the bullish camp that appear on all the media around the world are going to be starting to talk about this more regularly because they know that earnings are not going to be keeping pace with the growth that we've seen in the last 6 or 7 quarters. Now, that being the case, you have to look at the fact that now what they're preaching is, and it's very possible, that we're going to see that investors are willing to pay more for the same stock's earnings potential than they did before. Therefore, if a stock had a X amount of earnings and their earnings multiple, let's say, was 15, well, if you have an expansion of PE, means you're going to go from 15 to, let's say, 17, 18, 19, 20, whatever the number is. And that says that people are willing to pay a much higher premium for the same stock that they did sometime before. And there's no difference in the opportunity unless they believe that the growth is going to be growing dramatically over the next several years, because then you'll start having to catch up. So keep on the lookout for that particular item that you'll be seeing and hearing about very shortly, and more of it. But markets did hit a record last week. One of the things that happened was the Fed did come out with an announcement, and they kind of played both sides of the economy. On one hand, they said that, hey, economic conditions are getting a lot better, so you know what? We're going to taper. Markets immediately dropped down about 10 points on the S&P 500. Dow blew out pretty badly, and the NASDAQ did as well. Well, when the final information came out, and it was realized that while the Fed was pulling back about $10 billion per month of their purchases of bonds in the form of mortgage-backed securities or in the form of treasuries, the realization that interest rates would stay low for a really long time was then priced back in, and the markets turned around. You know, it's interesting because now supposedly we're going to see a lot more viewing of the and consideration put on the economic numbers when it comes to the Fed. The Fed also did say, of course, that they gave themselves a little bit of a breather, that if they need to increase it or decrease it or change it, they can do that. If, in fact, the unemployment rate hits their target, well, they may not scale back. Actually, what I did is I recorded the actual announcement when it came through CNBC, and I wanted you to hear exactly what the Fed did say.
The Federal Reserve announcing a $10 billion taper, $5 billion each of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. The Fed saying in light of cumulative progress in labor markets, the committee decided to modestly reduce the pace of its asset purchases. And they say if the data comes in as expected here with further improvement, they will taper further at future meetings. However, tapering is not on a preset course, the Fed says. The pace contingent on the outlook and the outlook for inflation and labor and the assessment of the efficacy and the cost of the program. But they are providing very dovish guidance on rates, saying the highly accommodative pace of current rates is appropriate for a considerable time. In fact, they're saying that they will be appropriate to maintain the current target range of the Fed funds rate well past the 6.5 unemployment threshold that they've said in the past, especially, they say, if inflation runs below 2%. So let me tell you, they've tapered, they provided future guidance for tapering, that's number two, but also provided very dovish guidance about interest rates on the way out. Let me give you some more details from the statement.
So now what this means really is that the Fed has given themselves a very nice range of possibilities where they can actually come in or do whatever they're going to do to accommodate for a very easy and a very liquid market. Now, on one hand, we want to believe that. You know, there's a lot to be said about the Fed's interest and why they're doing what they're doing and the understanding of economic models and their ability to forecast, which is pretty poor in general. As a matter of fact, Rosengren, who was the one dissenter in the opinion, came out this weekend and talked about how the Fed was usually pretty optimistic in their outlook and usually wrong, and that it wasn't really the time to taper at this point. But it's not the here nor there. They started doing it. What does that mean? We did see that rates did tick up towards the end of the week, and as a matter of fact, it's been 3 weeks of higher levels for the dollar. The dollar has hit a 3 or 4 week, maybe more than that, high. It was quadruple witching for the options on Friday, so that's where you get the high volume that the index and the stock options actually expired. So you had everything across the board kind of expiring and buying new and making pricing what they wanted to be. So you saw a lot of volatility there. But at the end of the day, you still have to kind of come back to where are the valuations and what's going to happen with exporters. We saw that utilities, telecoms, and the high dividend paying stocks really did well towards the end of the week. And that big reversal was pretty impressive overall when you look at it. So question is, where do you go from here? And it's really not as clear that we have a smooth path. But nonetheless, we do have a few things that are beneficial that you can point to if you really wanted to. The first thing is that you have end of year Christmas rally, Santa Claus rally. You have a few days that are really left, 6 or 7 trading days for the end of the year. You have that the January time period is coming up when you'll see a lot of potential money flow into markets due to the fact that 401ks and pension funds and hedge funds will be positioning themselves for 2014, potentially. We also have the contrarian trade that I talked about. We saw that I mentioned 2 or 3 weeks ago that we liked gold. We did buy gold. We did stop out of gold. No loss, no gain on that in our portfolios over at Horowitz Company on the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. And the reason with that is that once the taper came, we had a stop in because the idea was that if we did see a taper, the dollar would start rising, and a dollar rising and potentially for a Fed that was going to come out with positive comments would be negative to gold, and that did in fact happen. Dropped down pretty significantly, and then Friday did come back a bit, but you know, you still have that major amount of negative bias towards gold right now, silver as well. So what I thought we would do is talk about a lot more about this with someone who really knows about this. And who would that be? Well, that would be our guest of today, who I know that you like. And let's get right to him. Of course, back by popular demand, and I always get emails when I ask for what guests you want to hear. We have Sanjeev Das, Good friend of mine all the way from the down under. Going to talk about a variety of things. He has a great deal of knowledge and depth. An author, a prolific writer, and a good friend. How are you, sir? Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you too and to your listeners.
Thank you. So how are things down there? This is, let's see, we're going into winter, which means you're going into summer.
We're just going to basically be boiled, burnt, and basically starved of water to death. That's the normal Australian
summer. Nice, very nice. Actually, I do want to talk about Australia for a second because there's some interesting things going on. There's been a lot of talk by your government about, you know, questionable prices and about interest rates. They've been doing a lot more vocalization, it seems, recently about housing prices and all sorts of things. What's happening in Australia?
Well, essentially, we have a problem, and the problem is got to do with the fact of the high Australian dollar. And with the high Australian dollar, what the government did was cut interest rates very savagely. The central bank did that. And essentially, they're trying to manage the actual Australian dollar down to probably some. The central bank governor came out very unusually and actually posted a price target of one Australian dollar buys 85 cents US. Now, to put that into perspective, the peak was about 110. So that's like a 25% devaluation. So we're talking about serious falls here.
Mm-hmm.
And but the problem is, in cutting the interest rate, it's had no effect on the real economy. But what it's done, like it's done elsewhere in the world, is it's actually boosted asset prices. And we now have a housing bubble going on. Nobody's building new houses, by the way. But if you own your existing house, it's gone through the roof. And essentially, the central bank is now very, very reluctant to cut interest rates further for fear of stoking these. So now they have done, together with central banks around the world, I have to say, they're now into forward guidance. And have you ever thought about it, Andrew, that the term forward guidance is an oxymoron? How can you have backward guidance?
Yeah, no.
You have to have forward guidance.
Well, yeah, backward guidance, because the realization is that maybe the data was bad to begin with.
Exactly. So anyway, we have forward guidance. So our central bank governor is basically going around telling people lots of things. But this is actually a very common theme around the world, because as you know, with the taper, everybody basically talked about all this forward guidance. But in the end, there's a nagging feeling in the back of my mind that what this is really is, firstly, it's old-fashioned, it's just jawboning, which we've seen for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is they don't have many weapons left. And there's a very famous Robin Williams sketch, which you might remember, about a London policeman. And as you know, London policemen don't carry arms. So Robin Williams was joking that when the London policeman sees a thief, he just says, "Stop or I'll shout louder." And I think that that's basically what the central banks are doing. They just keep talking and hoping that something's going to happen.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, our central bank comes out with a discussion that they're going to use what they call a communications tool. Now, if you really think about it for a second, what is the communications tool? It's propaganda and rhetoric.
Well, Joseph Goebbels should probably have been employed by a central bank.
Right. Seriously, I mean, the whole idea of communication is to try to massage the markets as much as possible when they need it. It's simply, you know, having a blanket available at any given time in case somebody falls down and has a boo-boo.
Well, it's actually very funny because in the height of the Cold War, you remember how Western commentators used to laugh at Soviet propaganda.
Yeah,
In fact, we now have our own version of Pravda. It's actually coming out of the central banks and government.
It is. That's their job,
and what they're also doing is actually doing, I think, serious damage to markets. Because essentially the prices are essentially now meaningless. Because they're trying to manipulate them both through their words, but also through their actions. Now, when a central bank says something, you are forced, for better or worse, to believe them to be correct, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem now is they keep saying different things and different. They talk out of both sides
right,
of their mouth.
Right, and that,
and they're playing games of ambush. They just ambush you, basically.
Right.
You know, it's a remarkable thing.
Well, you remember something. I mean, you know, everybody in the world will be happy as long as markets or their particular portfolio moves higher because stocks and asset prices are moving higher. But once things don't go that direction, that's when everybody steps in. You know, you don't see ever a situation where a central banker comes in when a market roars 3 or 4% in a day to say, we're watching the markets very carefully. We are keeping an eye on things. No, it's only when they're down 3 or 4%
in a day that you see them come out with some kind of a discussion, you know, that they're going to make sure it's stabilized. Just like it happened this week with the Korean won. After the taper happened, there was a major amount, or the small amount of tapering that happened. There was a small amount of initial reaction that pushed the dollar higher, but it really did a lot of major movement on the emerging market currencies, right?
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, now you have them stepping in saying all these things. Now, in a way, they like that the currency is lower because it helps their exports. But you can't have everybody's currency lower because, you know, it just it's a meaningless move then. But just to get back to the taper, and then let's go into some of these other discussions about emerging markets, which is important. So Bernanke comes out and he does two things. First is, which we seem pretty much prepped for, was he said, hey, we're going to take back about $10 billion from the monthly purchase. We're going to split it, you know, up between treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. And at the same time, he said, by the way, we could always increase it. We could decrease it further or do whatever we want. And we're also saying that we're still concerned about the employment rate, even though we see it maybe going to 6.5 in the U.S. in the next however long, not too long. And as such, we're going to keep the very low rates, the 0 to 25 basis points, for an extended period of time. So what he did was he kind of gave a punch with the left hand, but a major love tap with the right.
Look, I think you've got to put this into a very much a personal and political perspective. The first and most important thing is this is Bernanke's last hurrah.
Yeah.
He's going.
Yeah.
And he does not want to go down in history as somebody who just blew the balance sheet up and basically left it there. So this is almost like his valedictory speech. He's saying, look, you know, I saved the world. I saved the U.S. economy. And look, I'm very responsible. I don't want to have hyperinflation. I don't want the central bank to basically be out of control. So I have put in place this process. Now, at the same time, he knows if he actually says that they're going to wind back in a major way, that would be catastrophic. So he's now going to blame his successor, Janet Yellen. Oh, well, you know, if I had been there, I would have done X and I would have done Y. So this has got to be put into that context. The second thing, and I think this is really important, is the $10 billion is neither here nor there, because they're still going to be pumping in $75 billion,
mm-hmm.
which is $900 billion a year,
mm-hmm.
which is roughly about 6% of GDP into the economy. Plus, people forget that the fiscal deal that was done in the Congress effectively means that the budget deficit is going to be slightly higher. And they're basically also pumping in money through the actual interest they're paying on excess reserves held with them. So the stimulus is still very, very substantial. And you can do a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation, which is the U.S. economy is growing at, say, 2%, which is about, give or take, $300 billion a year. The interesting thing is you now need a budget deficit of, say, around $600 billion, plus somewhere between $900 billion and $1 trillion of injection of liquidity from the central bank, plus other underhand things that are going on, to keep that growth going. And this is the really interesting thing. If you look at those numbers, this does not look like a great outcome.
Yeah, well, yeah. But at the same time, like you mentioned, that asset price inflation or reflation was part of the game, and that was a big issue. And, you know, if nothing else, people feel better. People feeling better turns into confidence. Confidence turns into potential spending. Spending turns into further growth of manufacturing, and it trickles down. I mean, we saw some great housing numbers, you know, in the context of housing numbers recently, okay? We saw some great housing numbers. We see the builders, you know, doing relatively well, depending on which ones they are. We've seen that employment. Now, the last employment number that we saw, the last two employment numbers we saw, we didn't see a major, the one before that was a problem. We didn't see a big spike down in the labor participation rate, so it's kind of semi-believable. Yet at the same time, we know there's an aberration coming, because if they don't put in extended benefits into the mix of this budget that they're going to do to further payment for unemployment benefits.
Long-term unemployed, yeah.
What's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of people that come out of the workforce after January, and you're going to see a further drop in the labor participation rate, which will probably push the unemployment rate, as Bernanke is expecting, to 6.5, but it will be an anomaly.
Look, I think just coming back firstly to the asset prices, this is one of the most extraordinary environments I've ever seen. I mean, equity markets are making new highs almost daily. And I was reading the Financial Times, and they published a risk analysis by a eminent firm of actuaries for the year 2014. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly enough, they didn't list war. Given what's going on in the East China Sea, that what I would have thought would have been at least rated a mention. But instead of that, they actually mentioned the prospect of an alien invasion.
Oh, nice.
But there was a reader who commented in the Financial Times about this particular risk of an alien invasion. He thought it would be positive for equity prices because equity analysts would argue that companies could look forward to gaining new non-human customers.
Right, and technology.
And technology. So, you know, this is just a bubbly environment, and the greatest bubble now is in all the analysts, or all sell-side analysts, who are arguing there is no bubble. But let's come back and see, okay, well, let's see the paper, and let's assume what's going to happen. We know the purchases are going to come down slightly, but we don't know whether they're going to come down more, because he's given himself a little wiggle room in terms of what happens in terms of actual numbers and actual economic activity. But he's also got rates now low, probably till 2016, 2017, by the sounds of it. He's got fiscal accommodation. So he's got all of that going on. And the biggest thing that people miss is even with this slight taper, the Fed balance sheet is going to reach about $4 trillion, which is about 25% of the U.S. economy. And there is no signs that they're going to try to sell this. And they can't sell this because the treasuries they own have an average maturity of give or take about 6 years. And the GSE securities they own have about roughly 3, maybe 3.5 years in maturity. So the best case is this will continue, this very accommodative thing will continue for somewhere between 3 and 6 years. And then, of course, you know, none of the existing people will be in power, and they won't have to worry about it. And the poor buggers who are coming after them and actually inherit this will turn around and look, now what do we do? So basically, you're going to be left with this massive withdrawal of liquidity. And also, let's look at, even in the short run, what the withdrawal of liquidity has had in terms of effects. The first thing is everybody's looking for the U.S. economy to continue to expand. But we've had long-term interest rates go up by 1%. Now, that's already reflected in mortgage rates, and we've seen some slowdown in mortgage refinancing, and that'll ultimately have some effect, effectively, on the building industry. But the other interesting thing that people forget, if the 10-year goes up 1%, that's going to have an impact on the government's interest costs. When you've got $16 trillion of debt, 1% on that is $160 billion. In reality, the effect's less because some of the debt won't have to be refinanced for some time. So you've got all this stuff going on, and the most important to me is the fact that the higher U.S. dollar as a result of higher interest rates is going to actually affect a lot of U.S. exporters. And the competitiveness that they've gained, they'll have to give some of that back. So it's not all good news, and so I actually don't think this is that significant. We're going to muddle along as best as we can, and I don't think the U.S. is going to fall off the edge of a cliff, but it's going to not have the kind of expansion everybody's looking at. And you're quite right about the employment numbers, because there's a lot of dynamics in the employment numbers which people don't talk about. And so under those circumstances, I still think the Fed's going to be accommodative. The U.S. is obviously going to grow, but not at an accelerated rate. And don't forget, we have the lunatics in charge of the asylum, namely Congress, and the debt ceiling is still coming up. And you can't rule out, given the midterms are coming up, some ructions from that particular sort of
corner. Yeah, no, I hear you. Now, you know, it's interesting. Two things I want to comment on. First of all, some time ago, maybe about a year ago, I had done some research and thinking about what would the effects of higher interest rates be. Because I was under the impression that as long as prices stay down and people expect that they will continue to stay down or be lower in general, you have what's called a deflationary environment. Okay. And one of the things why you want to inflate assets is in a way to put a fire under people's tuchuses to get them to do something. So I always thought that it was probably a good idea actually to raise rates or to do what you can to bring rates up a little bit in order to get them off the fence to push them into getting mortgages and buying homes. Now, what's interesting is that exact thing, if you think about it, has happened. Now, we're coming from a very low point, so a little bit of a rate increase is not that much for a 30-year or even a 15-year mortgage. But they did move up, and there were some people that were very concerned about this. Now, if you look about 3 months or so, maybe 5 months post when the rates started rising, you all of a sudden see a very interesting thing happening. You see the home building and the housing starts numbers reach their highs.
Yep.
So I think that a little bit of interest, and a little bit of an increase in interest, I should say, is actually not a terrible thing. But the second thing is that what's going to happen to the debt in 5 years from now, let's say, that the Fed has on their balance sheet. Now, I spoke to, I think you know him, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, you know, from okay, brilliant guy. I spoke to him a few months ago.
Only suspicious of people with hyphenated names.
Yeah,
couldn't they make up their minds or something?
Yeah, and by the way, I see them with a handlebar mustache and a bow tie.
Indeed. And speaking in a very proper English accent.
Right, and maybe a cane. Maybe just kind of walking along with a cane with you know.
But we saved them for central bankers together with the dark glasses and the seeing eye dog.
Right. So now, smart guy, and we talked about this, and one of the things he said I thought was just absolutely brilliant and horrifying at the same time. And that was that this debt will never be repaid. In other words, it will never be turned. So this debt is never going to have to be turned around. What's going to end up happening is over time that the Fed will start with government, because it's the same money hit there, just saying, you know what, you don't have to pay on that debt anymore. You know, those interest rates on that particular piece, on that tranche, you don't have to pay on. And that over time, they'll just disappear.
Well, that's been discussed quite a lot, which is if the Fed is actually buying this debt from the government, and basically they're both arms of the same entity, why can't you cancel it? Now, there are some interesting issues about that. If you do cancel it, then effectively the central bank becomes at least technically insolvent, because people forget that the $4 billion, or $4 trillion rather, which the Fed's balance sheet is going to reach, is supported by $54 billion in capital, which would make Lehman's and some of the investment banks and banks which got into trouble look unleveraged. Now, you can't apply the same rules to central banks as you can to other banks, because they obviously can print money and get their way out of it. But that is one of the solutions that you're going to actually see. And that is certainly on the cards. But it's a process of debasement of money at the end of the day. And that's basically what's going to happen, because there's no other way out of it. But you said something very important in the first part of your statement about inflation. Now, if you actually look at all these policies, let's sort of cut through it and say, okay, well, why did they do this? We can argue about whether the policy is right or wrong, but why did they do this? Is to create growth and inflation, because that's how you get out of it. But the problem of the whole scenario is that we haven't got the strong growth that we wanted, but most importantly, we're not getting very high inflation. And this is actually problematic, because if you get very low rates of inflation and possibly deflation, then the debt as a percentage of GDP will very quickly become unmanageable, which is a problem that Japan has. Right. And that'll force them to print more money trying to do this, as Japan is doing, trying to actually get out of it. So you get caught in almost like a negative spiral, and you just can't get out of it. There's no way out of it. And I think that is really the major concern now in that policy setting. All the games about taper and so forth are very interesting, but it's a question of whether we can get growth up a little bit and we can get, say, 2% inflation. Most people are worrying about hyperinflation, but in the short run, I think they probably are worrying about the wrong thing. I think it's about disinflation or deflation that you should be worried about.
I would tend to agree, and it's still also very fascinating how the potential for deflation is there with the amount of money that's been pumped into economies around the world. But, you know, we can go on about that. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on in Europe, because there's some things that are happening in Europe. For example, we're seeing that the default rate for Spanish banks in particular are really problematic. One of the big things is that they have so much bad debt on the books, and they have not gone through a full cycle of either writing off or writing down, or, you know, doing what they can to kind of, you know, make this all back to a normalized state. And that's becoming a bit of a problem. And one of the things it's doing is pushing Europe now to and the ECB to force them to write down some of these at a much more a quicker pace. But also the backdrop of this, you know, Euro banking thing that's going on. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, well, let's back up a stage. The first thing that's very important to understand is the problem with Europeans is, well, they're European. When the Americans had a problem, they were they were basically very upfront. There are a lot of things that people like and dislike about America, but one of the good things about Americans generally is when they have a problem, they go, okay, we've got a problem, so we've got to fix it. And they have a lovely way of moving on by saying, okay, well, we made a mistake, so fix it and get on with life. You know, it's like in America, they joke that an entrepreneur isn't an entrepreneur until he's been bankrupt 3 times. If you say that to a European,
right,
they'd be horrified. The thought of bankruptcy is like basically being labeled a pedophile in Europe. So basically, you just don't want to go there. So the fundamental problem is they've never dealt with their problems in the banking system. And they have potentially, and everybody lies about this, so you can't tell, but they could have €1 trillion of bad debts, which would do substantial damage, as you can imagine, to the solvency of the banking system. Mm-hmm. Italy alone has $250 billion, and Spain, of course, because of its huge log of construction debt, has similar problems. And they need to deal with this. And the way they've dealt with this is by these cockamamie stress tests, and we're about to have another one. This time it's called an AQR, Asset Quality Review. It's interestingly being done by a consulting firm which is notorious for having basically labeled Allied Irish, which had to be bailed out to the tune of €30 billion by Ireland, the world's best managed bank, just before this happened, of course. Mm-hmm. So they come with really good credentials in terms of, of doing these types of stuff. So they're going to look at this. But the real problem is they will look at some of the things like the construction loans and so forth. They won't look at what I consider to be the biggest problem, which is the European banks basically own a heck of a lot of sovereign bonds issued by European sovereigns.
Well, they were forced to.
Exactly. And what has happened is a couple of years ago, the European Union said they wanted to break the actual loop between the banks and the sovereigns. They haven't done that. And in fact, we jokingly now refer to it as the doom loop. And in fact, what has happened is the concentration has grown. Because what is actually going on in Europe, and this is why yields for many European sovereigns are very low, unrealistic relative to their financial position, is what happens is, let's say you're a Spanish bank, you buy Spanish government bonds, then you take them to your central bank, and your central bank borrows money from the ECB and lends you money against the collateral of the Spanish banks. That's number one. Number two is that you don't have to hold any capital against it because it's your sovereign. Mm. So they've created a massive mess. Now, I don't know how they're going to get out of this. But one of the ideas was to create a banking union. And this was part of the famous tripartite solution to the European debt crisis. Step one was what came to be known as the Growth and Stability Pact, or GSP. And that basically meant everybody was going to bring their budget deficits under 3% and cap their debt at 60%. Now, that's one of those wonderful things that are going to be capped in the actual breach. Sorry, they're going to be actually evidence in the breach rather than the observance. Everybody's missing them, and they're pushing out the targets. Now, then the second leg was basically the famous Mario Draghi outright monetary transactions, which is the unlimited buying of bonds by the central bank in Europe. The interesting thing is it's never been invoked. We don't know whether it works or doesn't work, and there seem to be disagreements among different countries as to what it actually means. And the last one was the banking union. But the problem with the banking union is if you're going to have centralized control of banks, you basically need to have a one authority controlling this. And secondly, you need to have some money in terms of deposit insurance schemes and a recapitalization fund, which, remember, was what the U.S. had through the TARP process, where they injected a massive amount of money into the banking system to basically recapitalize them. Now, the first problem here is this is a very European process, and they've been arguing about it for about probably the better part of a year. And they have now reached sort of a conclusion. In Europe, nobody ever reaches a conclusion. It's sort of always getting there. It's sort of what I call asymptotic discussions. You never quite get to the end. And in this particular case, they've reached an agreement, but it's one of those wonderful things which are designed by committees. So basically, there's going to be a centralized body dealing with all of this. And the problem with that is nobody actually could accept that. So the centralized body only has jurisdiction over a small number of banks. But then the national central banks and national regulators are also involved. So to give you some idea of this in a very simple way, if, rather like the FDIC, you had a bank which couldn't meet its debts and you had to wind it up, in Europe it would go through 9 committees, and you would need 153 votes to basically get this done. And apparently this all is going to be done over a weekend.
But what's good about this is the amount of actual meals that will be served in the restaurant business.
Well, that's the only way they basically are going to have a recovery. It's going to be a regulator and discussion-led recovery. The second thing is there's going to be no centralized bailout fund or recapitalization fund. The Germans, who would have had to pay for this, don't basically want to do that. So wait for it. They're going to raise $55 billion. Billion euros, I beg your pardon. Over 10 years. And this fund will be operational in 2025.
$55 billion?
€55 billion. Now,
that's not a lot of money.
No, and Allied Irish cost $30 billion on its own.
So yeah, Cyprus was the same thing. It was like $30-40 billion.
Yeah, and so they're basically there's not enough money to actually.
Well, they're going to leverage it though. They're going to leverage it, right? That's
no,
the plan.
No. They can't leverage it.
They can't leverage it.
It's going to be actually money. It's going to be raised by levies on the existing banks. So basically, there's not going to be enough money, and they won't agree to an Europe-wide deposit scheme. Because basically, it all comes down to a simple thing. The Germans would have to pay for it, and the Germans aren't going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which has led to some very interesting things. You were talking about Spain. Spain's a fascinating sort of case study. You're quite correct. The Spanish banks are in serious difficulties, despite the fact that their stock prices have rallied quite savagely in the last 6 months. But this is the way the Spanish government proposes to basically recapitalize the banks. Because the banks are losing money, they obviously have some what we call future income tax benefits. This is the tax that they would save if in the future they earned money, because they could offset that against the losses. So basically, they're going to use roughly 50 billion euros of these losses to recapitalize the bank by the state guaranteeing these losses.
Basically just going to move from one side of the of the balance sheet to the other to recapitalize them?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Got that.
And just think about it. This is the way you raise capital for a bank. Go out and make bigger losses.
Basically, you're going to take your losses, and you're going to take the losses off of the books, or, you know, side pocket them, and therefore they have a better capitalization ratio overall from an asset liability standpoint, and therefore you are better off.
Correct.
That's silly.
Well, it's such a good idea. The Spanish are doing it. Now every other European country has decided this would be a wonderful way to recapitalize their banking system.
Well, in the U.S. they did a bit of that too. They rolled back some laws and allowed for different accounting methodologies with valuation of land values and property values. And they allowed some – listen, some of the home builders are still getting a ton of money due to the fact that they are allowed to bring forward other losses.
Yes, no, that's right. So this goes on everywhere, but in Europe, they take it to a new surreal level. So basically, the net is that the European banking system will continue to have problems, but the most important effect of that is they're contracting lending. They're shrinking their balance sheets very, very rapidly, and which means that in Europe, one of the underpinnings of a recovery needs to be some availability of credit to good businesses. That's just not there. And so that's compounding all the other difficulties, which is governments cutting back on spending, high unemployment, low investment, but now you've got no lending as well.
Why don't they just cut the shenanigans and just say, you know what, we're going to wipe them clean and just, you know, let them just go on and you know, that's it. Next time they do it,
that you were wrong in the first place.
Oh,
we are Europeans.
Yeah, well, you know what, interestingly, do you remember there was a time when there was a big concern that the the European Sovereign Debt Fund, you know, the fund they had, the EFSF,
yep,
I believe it was, that it had to be a AAA rated for participation and all. Remember that whole thing?
Yes,
if one of the countries kind of got knocked down, it's a big problem. That was recently, 2 months ago. It was downgraded and nobody flinched.
Well, that's because they're arguing that the fund is going to be rolled into the new bailout, which is the European Stability Mechanism, which is actually structured slightly differently, so it no longer matters.
And by the way, if it does matter, what they'll do is they will make the rating agencies null and void.
Yes, exactly. And they're having this ongoing, they're going to sue the rating agencies for basically having downgraded the sovereigns, to put it mildly, which is quite a bizarre process. So look, Europe's going to be stuck in this doom loop for a long, long time. And the best output of this that you can see is Europe won't fall off the edge of a cliff, but it's not going to grow very strongly either, which makes it hugely problematic. And I think the other interesting thing is there's always a problem in Europe, which is political. I don't know whether you've been following the Italian political process.
With Berlusconi, you mean?
And no, no, Berlusconi is now out, obviously.
I know, that was unbelievable. Now he's going to jail, the poor guy.
No, it's going to be gradually. No more bunga bunga parties for him.
Yeah, no kidding.
But the most interesting thing is the Constitutional Court in Italy found that all the elections since about 1992 are actually unconstitutional because they changed the laws, which really now raises a very interesting point. There is a very deep point, which is all the laws that have been passed since then, are they valid or are they not valid?
Which is inclusion in the euro.
Well, everything. Now, the next thing is, because of this and some internal politics within the PD party, which is the party, which is the ruling party, they're probably going to have an election again within 12 months. And that election is going to be very, very divisive. And so, in the meantime, nothing's going to happen in Italy. They're not going to do anything because they can't. And on the other side, they're going to have another round of political instability. And, you know, Mr. Berlusconi, whatever else you say about him, is absolutely the jack-in-the-box who keeps popping up. So you can never discount his role in any future election.
Well, he needs to be there. Yeah, if he stays in political power, he stays out of jail.
That's right. And
which is really bizarre, by the way, but that whole thing.
Which it is. So we have those types of things in Europe, and we have this bizarre thing called the European elections in May. I mean, these are a bunch of people who sit in basically in Strasbourg and who basically make laws, which then the national parliaments are meant to enact. But basically, that whole process will go through, and we don't know what's going to happen. The thing to watch there is how much representation the extreme right and the extreme left get. And that's going to be an interesting sort of tale of what I would call the democratic problems in Europe. And there are little things going on like Cyprus and Greece. Greece's debt stability and debt sustainability will come under question. They're meant to get down to 120% of GDP. The IMF has admitted that there's no way they're going to do that. It's going to be 160%, in which case the IMF can't lend them any more money. All sorts of things are going on. So the best way to describe it is in Europe, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to touch before you go on the U.S. banking situation. You know, the lawsuits that are flying around and the money that's being paid. I think it's very fascinating, and particularly with J.P. Morgan, how J.P. Morgan was pretty much milked pretty well recently. And I don't know, you probably could add it up to close to $20
billion
maybe, around?
Close to $30 billion. Now, I actually did the numbers the other day.
Now, tell me something. You know, I remember the days, and this was not that long ago, that if there was a $50 million write-off, that a stock would just get collapsed. It would be bad.
Indeed.
We're talking about $30 billion of repayment. How does the stock stay elevated as it has and not even flinch with all this going on?
Well, I think there's a deeper question here about the profitability of banking. And I just want to basically pose two questions for you. The first is the Federal Reserve is holding excess reserves of roughly $2.4 trillion on which they're paying 0.25%.
Mm-hmm.
That means they're translating $6 billion to the banks every year. Mm-hmm. And the American taxpayer is paying for that.
Mm-hmm.
And J.P. Morgan would obviously get a share of that. The second thing, I did a very simple back-of-the-envelope calculation. Now, last year, J.P. Morgan made about, give or take, say, $30 billion pre-tax.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, if you look at their deposits, they've got about $1.2 trillion in deposits from Mr. and Mrs. Smith in Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not paying any interest, basically, on that because money market rates are so low. But they could just take that and buy government bonds with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would make 2%. So mm-hmm. 2% of $1.2 trillion is $24 billion pre-tax.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 82% of their actual pre-tax earnings. So in a perverse way, what I'm saying to you is that and the excess reserves is where most of the earnings are coming from most of the banking system. So probably the really smart investors have realized all these write-offs and all that stuff doesn't really mean anything because the government is taking these fines with the one hand but giving the money back indirectly
through all of these processes.
This
is exactly what I thought when I looked at this. I said, wait a minute, the only thing that really makes sense here is that the realization that there was like not really a side deal, but hey, don't worry about it. You're going to keep on getting all this money from us. Don't really sweat it.
And that's absolutely right, because when you look at things like the return on equities, in the heydays of before 2007, 2008, you were getting basically returns of equity of 15 to 25%, depending on which bank you looked at. Now they're down in low single figures.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at their PE multiples, they're back to the 2007, 2008 levels.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, sorry, how does this two reconcile? And it's, and it's basically, effectively the best way to describe it is banks are now arms of the state.
Right.
So well, basically they can't At least you can invest in them because you can't invest in the government.
Right. Well, I mean, and the thing is that the banks won't, if they were given the ability to, I don't think they would detach from the state either, because you have them as a, you know, fail-safe in the event that something goes haywire in some way. And they say, you know what, we'll live with the fact that they're going to be our best friends, because for whatever reason, the banks are allowed to get away with a lot of things. The first is, you know, government and central banks are allowed to say and do whatever they want and get away with it. The second one is then banks. And then from there, you're pretty much just a downhill slope pretty hard that, you know, other people aren't allowed to get away with anything. You know, unless it is something with regard to currencies, which is, not even a regulated market, or commodities, which is just a disaster under Gensler, in my opinion. But it's really fascinating a situation. And at the end of the day, what does it all come down to? It comes down to the fact that there's money involved, and you know what? People want to make money, and you make money at all sorts of levels. Don't forget about Bernanke. Now he's going to have a great speaking gig. Or look what happened with our latest, Treasury secretary. He got a nice little gig going there at UBS.
Look, it's quite interesting in that sort of process. But the most amusing thing is, if you just list what you've just listed, which is the fines they've paid, the fact the actual market rigging allegations in things like interest rates, FX, and commodities, all of these types of things. And you saw this happening to any industry other than banking. So say it happened in, say, retail or in the technology industry. What would the government do to that industry?
Oh, man, destroy it. Regulate it.
Exactly. And as I said to people, if you actually look at it, these are sort of the antitrust violation levels that led to the breakup of Standard Oil.
Mm-hmm.
That's the level of these, you know, the robber barons were broken up. You have the same process, but now it seems to be sponsored by the government.
Right. Well, again, they want everybody to be happy. Well, and then it relates back to the whole issue of government is no longer the idea of serving the people. It's the idea of I have a job and I have benefits and I have my future taken care of me because I'll be a lobbyist or I'll be a speaker or I'll work at some hedge fund later in life.
Well, I think there's a standard joke, which I think is still a very good line, is most new politicians come to Washington to serve the people. Once they're there for a little while, they just help themselves.
Yeah. Good one. Das, always a pleasure talking with you, and I want to thank you for all the things you've done and being such a great guest, not only today, but throughout the years and the year. And I want to wish you a welcome 2014, a wonderful holiday season to you and yours, and we're going to talk a lot next year, I know that, and I appreciate everything you do. Make sure to pick up his book over on Amazon. He's got a few of them out there. Traders, Guns, and Money, I believe is one of them.
And Extreme Money is the other one.
Extreme Money is the other, right.
Great but you don't stuff, need to buy book. Them. They're probably pirated somewhere.
Nice. And he's also independently wealthy, obviously, on all of this. but no, that's great. I appreciate it. Oh, listen, we'll talk soon.
Talk soon. All the best to you and yours. Thanks. And all your listeners for 2014. May you get filthy rich next year.
Yes, absolutely. Or get elected to a government office, either one.
In which case, you also get to be filthy rich.
Exactly. All right, I'll see you later. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Well, what can I say? Das is the best. Love him. Actually, Frank Kersey is going to be with us next week, wrapping up the year of 2013 and taking us into 2014. You know that he is a specialist when it comes to small cap stocks, which have been absolutely incredible in 2013, so much so that their fundamentals and PE ratio is well out of whack from historical standards. So what I want you to do right now is reflect on some of the things that we talked about this year, and I tell you something, I am incredibly surprised at the resilience that we saw of the U.S. markets. And if some of you are scratching your head and wondering, what is it, why is it, how is it that we're seeing that the U.S. market continues to do so well in the face of many of these things that we see, like the taper or the various items and issues that go on in Congress, or any of the things that you could think about when it comes to earnings, etc. Consider the fact that it's possible that money is being removed from other places. For example, when it comes to the Japanese markets, while there is an interesting and incredible push towards the movement of lowering down the valuation of the yen, if you want to be in equities, there is the idea that, hey, why not take some of my money out of the Japanese markets right now? Maybe if you're a Japanese investor, hedge fund or pension, and put it into where I believe we're going to get the best bang for the buck from an environment of economic growth, stability, Fed backing, but yet an increasing currency. So what you do is you take the money out and you move it over here. Now, what happens is that if nothing else, if the idea is implanted in your head that, hey, we're going to see that the yen continues to move lower and continue its downward path in valuation, wouldn't it be a great way to play both sides, get opportunities to be invested in stocks, and at the same time, have a currency that's going to move up compared to the current currency that we have? So you get both sides of the equation. Now, we talked about this year, about how when you invest in a Japanese ETF, for example, one of the things you have to be careful of is that you may get the opportunity of having an increasing value of the underlying stocks, but the currency itself has moved down in such a way, or could move down, that you may not get the same bang for your buck. So while you look at the Japanese index, the Nikkei, as an example, which is up 52% year to date, if you take out the currency exposure and the currency effect, you're only up 27%. In other words, there was a big diversion of valuations if you do it based on currency. Now, does that affect you? Well, possibly. It depends on how you invest. If you hedge out your currency risk entirely by maybe going the opposite direction with your Forex, well, then, okay, great. If you don't, though, and you just invested, for example, in a fund that does not have any currency hedging that goes on, when you return it back to dollars, you're much worse off. So just consider that when you're thinking about investing in any foreign ETF, as an example, for a near-term trade. Obviously, currencies move back and forth and move up and down, dependent on a variety of things. But long-term, where is it going to be? And consider where it is short-term. So short-term, it may be a trade that you want to hedge. And long-term, you may not care as much, possibly. Or you may want to say that you're going to put a little bit of a hedge on, but not as much because we're not sure exactly what the total movement is going to be and where it's going to end. Right now in Japan, it seems like they're just absolutely desperate. We're still not seeing a lot of companies spending money, even though there's a push to have them spend money, increase salaries, et cetera. They're still, companies in Japan are still hoarding cash. Every metric that you look at is showing that. So take a look around. Europe still has a lot of problems, like Das talked about. One of the things I do want to mention is the housing market of late. One of the things that, if you remember, I was a big proponent of some time ago was increasing the rates of interest. So the Fed going and trying to actually increase some of the interest rates in order to get people off the fence and to be buying new homes or pushing themselves and forcing them to refinance their mortgage, get a new mortgage. And I think some of that has really come to play. You see that now we saw one of the best housing numbers that we've seen in a while. GDP miraculously hit 4.1 from a 3.6 revision, or a little bit less than that. Revision was much higher than anticipated, blew out overall what the expectations were. We're still running at about a 2% or so year over year, but the month to month was pretty impressive. Pretty impressive that we saw on Friday. Leading indicators were up as well. Some of that has to do with the stock market. But the one thing that you look at when you look at the GDP was a third of the numbers came in from inventory growth. And inventory growth is a double-edged sword because in inventories, you have the opportunity that you have more manufacturing and the potential that manufacturers are seeing that there's more sales coming in, and as such, they will do their best to increase their inventories. On the other hand, when sales don't pick up and you have a sales an inventory rise, that's a negative, even though it will be a positive point for GDP. So when we look at the inventory to sales numbers, we just ran those, we're pretty much at the same level we've seen over the last several months. It did come down in 2013 from where it was, meaning that there is more selling going on and there is more consumption happening of the goods. That's a good thing. The question is going to be after this holiday season, what really plays out. We don't have the full numbers in yet. We don't know exactly what was sold. But at the same time, we do know that there's a lot of rebates and sales that went on. So maybe, in fact, we do see that the inventory movement is properly allocated and the growth is properly calculated at this point. Anyway, I want to wish you a very happy and a healthy holiday, whether you're celebrating whatever it is. And again, we'll come back next week with Frank Curzio. And I look forward to seeing you then. Have a great holiday. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.